Yeah, I think it's.
Okie dokie. So, for the record, this is Jinryu, and it is Sunday, October the 5th. Right? And I'm going to talk about the Bahia Sutra. I have wanted to talk about this sutra for a long time. That doesn't mean I've been studying it for a long time. But I'll tell you how I learned about it. I think it has been a year, maybe 18 months, since I was in a group reading the book by Reb Anderson, Entering the Mind of Buddha, which is a book on the six perfections. Just so you know, they are dana or generosity, ethical behavior, patience, perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. And in the chapter on concentration, he included the Bahia Sutra. And I read and I read the teaching, and I thought, where has this been my whole life? I had never heard it before, but I knew it deep down inside. I knew that this thing existed. So that's when I thought that other people need to hear about this. Come to find out, Domio has mentioned it a couple of times on her podcasts. The truth be told, I did not listen to her podcast much. But I started physical therapy on my knee in January, and they made me do the life cycle. I mean, life cycle is just so boring. So I started listening to her podcast. So the Bahia Sutra is one, she has a section, 12 sutras everyone should know, and it's one of those. And she also has an actual podcast on it itself. So what I want to do is talk through the sutra. When I come to the part about the teaching, I will read that because you don't really want to mess that up. And we'll take a look at what we can learn from Bahia's life. And then we'll take a look at the actual teaching. It starts out, as some of them do, with, I have heard. This I have heard, or I have heard, which means it's attributed to Ananda, one of the Buddha's disciples. Ananda had an eidetic memory. And so he could recall things with pinpoint accuracy. And so we attribute the telling, the repeating of this sutra to him. And the two main characters are the Buddha and a man named Bahia. Now, I'm not big on switching around and sharing and all that stuff. So consider this the subcontinent of India. Can you guys see it? Yeah. It comes down to a little point. Over here is a rounded looking peninsula. That's Gujarat. Just below that is where Bahia lived. In a seaside town. And at the time, why is my, I'm so bad at this. At the time, the Buddha, as usual, was living in the area of Jetta's Grove. And that is way over on this side of India, just under the border with Nepal, where it is today. Now, I don't know about where Nepal existed, if it did in the Buddha's time, but it's way over on the other side of the Indian subcontinent. They call Bahia Bahia of the Bark Cloth because in an earlier life, he was shipwrecked. And so he had to use the bark of trees to clothe himself. So he is called Bahia of the Bark Cloth. And he was a holy man. He was worshiped. He was revered. when he went out on alms rounds, he was given everything you can imagine, money and food, places to live. He was known for caring for the sick, and so they gave him medicine to continue his work with the sick. And every now and then, at the end of the day, he's tired. He's going through his day thinking about how it went, and he would wonder, am I an arhat? And then he would say to himself, maybe I'm an arhat, maybe I'm not. Did I screw this up? But maybe at least I'm on the path of arhatship. Well, a deva in the sky overheard this. Now, it just so happens that in a previous life, she was a cousin of Bahia's, and she felt kind of sorry for him. So she came down and said, she was very frank. And she said, Bahia, you are not an arhat. And she said, you're not even on the path. And this was very upsetting to him. And he goes, then who in this world is an arhat and can tell me how to get on the path of being an arhat? An arhat, for those who may not know, is an enlightened being. I should have said that earlier. And she said, in the northern part of this country, in a town near Shivati, is a guy they call the Blessed One. He is an arhat. He has self-awakened, and he teaches the Dharma, and he can tell you how to get on the path of being an arhat. But he wastes absolutely no time. He drops everything right then and there and takes a hike to find this Blessed One. Now, the reason why I did this thing with Bahia here and the Buddha here, that's about 1,600 kilometers, according to Google Maps. And he did that in one night. So we have, always the element of the supernatural. And finally, he gets to the area where the Buddha is, and he sees some monks walking in Kinhin. And he goes up to them and he says, where can I find this Blessed One? And they said, well, he's already gone into town. He's on alms round. And so then Bahia keeps going, and he goes into the town of Shavati to find the Blessed One. And he finally sees him, serene and inspiring, serene confidence, calming, his senses at peace, his mind at peace, having attained the utmost tranquility and poise, tamed, guarded, his senses restrained, a great one. Seeing him, Bahia approached and threw himself at the Buddha's feet. And he said, teach me the Dharma, O Blessed One, teach me the Dharma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss. And the Blessed One turns to him and he says, not right now. We're on alms round, and if we don't get alms, we don't get to eat. So the Buddha keeps going, but Bahia is not to be deterred, throws himself at the feet of the Buddha again. But it's hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Blessed One's life, or what dangers there may be for my life. Oh, Blessed One, teach me the Dharma. Oh, one well gone, teach me the Dharma that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss. Not now. We're on alms round. But he has not given up. But it's hard to know for sure what dangers there may be in your life and what dangers there may be for mine. Teach me the Dharma, O Blessed One, teach me the Dharma, O one well gone, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss. The Buddha realizes this guy's not going away. And so he says, then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, then you are neither there, nor here, nor anywhere in between. When there is no you there, I just said that. There is neither, you are neither here, nor there, nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma from the Blessed One, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth right then and there was released from affluence through lack of clinging, sustenance. Now, this is from an essay that Tanisaro Bhikkhu did. I got it from Access to Insight. And for some reason, in his translations, he uses a slash as if he doesn't want to make a decision between two words. I say make a decision, but it's clinging slash sustenance. I kind of get them both. But anyway, he is released from all affluence. Now, I had to look that up. It's cares, worries, opinions, fears, obstacles, beliefs, any kind of obstacle that keeps him from seeing clearly. And he is released from all that. And although it doesn't say it, generally speaking, being released from all that, that leaves him free to see the truth. So the Buddha continues on his rounds, and Bahia, we don't know really where he goes, whether he goes back to see the monks or whether he ends up going back home. But he has an accident, and he gets in between a cow and its calf, and he's killed. And that's a real thing. I looked that up. In the state of Oregon, 20 such deaths are reported every year during calving season. Someone accidentally gets between the cow and the calf, and the cow's not having it, and it ends in disaster. So that's what happened to Bahia. So when the Buddha returns from his alms round, he sees Bahia, and he can tell he's dead. On seeing him, he said to the monks, "Take Bahia's body, monks, and place it on a litter, and carrying it away, cremate it, and build him a memorial. Your companion in the holy life has died." Bahia is really one of us. And so I wanted to, this man led an exemplary life and he still was not satisfied. And he still questioned himself. So a big thing we can learn from Bahia's life is self-inquiry. It is encouraged in Buddhism. In fact, there is a sutra that was not named where they talk about the Buddha goes into a particular village and the villagers there say, "Now you, we had a guy 2 weeks ago and he was talking his stuff. Then we had another guy a week back and he was saying something entirely different. This stuff is really confusing. What are we supposed to believe?" And the Buddha says, "You are right to question. When you have seen it and experienced it for yourself to be right and true, then you can accept it. But until then, you have a right to question everything. Just because a teacher says it," I tend to believe them, "but just because a teacher says it, just because an ancestor says it, it needs to be right and true for you based on your own experience. So he's teaching the value and benefit of the direct experience. We learn that from Bahia's life. And other scholars have said, you know, you need to keep this questioning going, and you need to question with an open mind. Had he not been open-minded and clear-headed, the Bahia would not have heard the Deva. Another thing that we can learn from Bahia is practice like your hair's on fire. You know, we used to say that all the time way back when here at Brightways Inn a long time ago. And I don't hear that expression much as much as I used to. But Bahia clearly had a sense of urgency. He walked 1,600 kilometers in one night. Upon hearing that there was an Arhat out there, he finally meets the Buddha. He is very respectful, but he's urgent. He's insistent. He is telling us that there is no time like right now to learn and to hear the truth. So he is persistent. He has a lot of urgency in his approach to the Buddha and in his communication with the Buddha. He practices with the knowledge of impermanence, because he says all the time, but we don't know what's going to happen to you. We don't know what's going to happen to me tomorrow. So he keeps this teaching of impermanence very upfront for him in his practice. And finally, another thing we can learn from what the Buddha tells Bahia and what happens to Bahia is freedom from the self. It's not the teaching of not self. It is highly related to that, though. It's when you're not there, if you can get yourself out of that, when you're not there, you're not here, you're not in the middle, get yourself away from that. Free yourself from fears, opinions, beliefs, worries, jealousy, anger. Free yourself from all of that, and you will not be there. And then there will be no more suffering. You know, when I first heard that, and I wanted to say it, I had it written in the margin and I just forgot it. I had a sense of relief. I had a sense of peace when I first read that. So what about what the Buddha teaches Bahia? As I said in my little write-up in the newspaper, the sutra is only about 2 pages long, barely. The teaching is 9 lines. But this is what it covers. It covers non-attachment, self-inquiry, attention and mindfulness, right speech, impermanence, anatta, studying the self, and most importantly, the direct experience. So that's why I call it the Buddha's elevator speech, because in 9 lines, he covers almost all of his teachings to this one man, Bahia. It also reminded me of the Genjo Koan. But then a lot of things remind me of the Genjo Koan. This is my favorite pair of lines, and I can't memorize them. I don't know why I can't. Conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. So don't overlay your opinion, your fear, your worry onto the scene that you're witnessing. Take all that stuff, take all the effluence out of it, and be aware of your direct experience. Allow things to come toward you, and you will be fully realized. Another way of saying is, saying this is don't get caught up in your own story, which I know I do. Don't identify with what's going on in your mind. I had a friend, Molly. I met her when we first moved here about 18 years ago. And I barely had the chance to get to know her because after I had been here a year, she had a debilitating stroke. And she lived with the results of that for 10 years. She died about a year or two ago. Those numbers don't add up, but I'm just telling you the way I remember it. But anyway, when Molly was her whole self, she was older than I am. She had a grown daughter with a family of her own, and she had a grandson who was about 18 or 19 years old, who was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And he was a mess. And he was in jail, and then he'd clean up, and then he'd get out of jail, and then he'd go back at the drugs and the alcohol again, and then he'd go back to jail. It was just ridiculous. And Molly would say, I know my grandson is an alcoholic. I know he's an addict. I just wish I didn't have an opinion on it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, she understood that it was her opinion, her thoughts, her worries and fears that were causing her suffering. Domio puts it this way in her instructional poem, which we recited today. Sink below the level of thinking and be aware of your direct experience, realizing it can never be grasped, but flows endlessly. The Buddha was teaching us about experiencing things directly and not getting caught up in our story. But stories are incredibly useful. And guess what? We tell them all the time. And we're not going to stop. Stories teach history. Stories perpetuate legend. Where would we be without the legend of the Buddha, without the legends of the Old West? Without, in my case, believe it or not, the story of my parents, in some of your cases, the story of your grandparents, or God, yeah, grandparents, of World War II. But that's what we do. Stories teach morality. They teach good behavior and ethical living. They record history. They provide entertainment. They are the source of books, and theater and music. I only brought one book with me. And this one I highly recommend. Robert Wright, Why Buddhism is True. I've read it twice. I will probably read it again. Robert Wright is an evolutionary psychologist. And so he studies evolution, trying to get a handle on the human mind and how it evolved into the people that we are today. And he, along with many of his colleagues, evolutionary psychologists, just for the purposes of telling a story, for the purpose of explaining themselves, they divide the mind up into modules or sections. In this case, these two psychologists call them different selves. So there is the self of self-protection. There is the self of mate attraction and mate retention, the self of affiliation, society, the self of family care, kin care, he calls it, the self of disease avoidance. In this short paragraph, he's focusing in on the self of mate acquisition. As for the mate acquisition module, it doesn't just encourage us to get away from the crowd and find an intimate bistro. It structures the conversation that takes place in that bistro. It may be, for example, and it may, for example, encourage us to say unflattering things about any perceived rival for the mate sitting across the bistro table from us. And this deflation of rivals is no closer to the truth than the story the guy is telling about himself to puff himself up so that he can attract this mate and he can get the best mate, have the best children, and perpetuate on and on and on. He says the deflation of the rival is no closer to the truth than the self-inflation that is also high on the agenda for this particular conversation. But the deflation is felt in the heart. We tend to believe the bad publicity we give rivals, the better to spread it. It's a lie. And we believe it. We just keep saying it. The more you say it, the more you believe it. And then it becomes true. Well, it's true. But the Buddha knew that. We can't help but do this. We have evolved into beings who do this. And that is why he said, then Bahia, train yourself this way. The operable word for me is train. You're not really going to get it. But train, practice in this way. Now, Bahia's transformation was immediate, but he was a holy man. He wasn't on the Buddhist path, but he understood these things far more than you and I probably do today. And we've evolved, and we still tell these stories, and we still believe them. And so we have to practice this way. Self-inquiry comes up again. Domio talks about it in her podcast. Don't just brush it aside. Sit with those stories. One teacher said, sitting with the story and welcome it. And it reminded me of the poem, which I decided not to read because I read it a lot, but it's Rumi's poem, The Guest House. You know, it's a gorgeous morning, and you open the front door, and there is anger. Where did he come from? But you don't fight it. You invite anger in. You invite fear in. You sit down and make him a cup of tea. And after a while, they will leave of their own accord. But we question, we play with these questions. I'm starting to learn that if something's kind of bad, I'll feel it right here and it's immediate. And if it's a little worse, I'll feel it just, it'll go a little bit deeper, a little further down. And if it's a shock, it'll get me in the horror. And this questioning of what is going on with ourselves, questioning ourselves, is a wonderful way, I think. I mean, it kind of coincides with the way Domio talks about relating to our karma. And so I'm going to use this pattern myself to uncover more and more of my karma because that's where I am today. I meant to put a little thing right here. Some of you may have been here for my talk of about a month ago, August. And I used an example of a road rage incident in a parking lot that I had witnessed. I was practically in it, but these two guys were going at it. And I used that example to illustrate what Uchiyama Roshi had said about driven parents really raising children to be driven, and they sharpen their claws and they bare their teeth. So I use that road rage incident as an example. Well, that parking lot is the parking lot of my favorite grocery store, and I go by there many times. And one time I drove up the very parking driveway that the instigator of the road rage was on. And I saw the big planter. Remember, I said there was a big planter there, and a Jeep had been illegally parked on the other side of it. But when I saw how big that planter was, I mean, it was two car lengths wide. It had a Japanese maple on each end and a ginkgo tree in the middle. That's how big it was. You could park two Jeeps there. And this guy in this gigantic, tall, I'm getting myself worked up again. This guy in this gigantic, tall automobile starts screaming and yelling and hand gestures and the whole bit, even as he's driving away. And I thought to myself, why? And I thought, maybe he's lost his job. Maybe he's getting a divorce. Maybe he lost a dear friend. Maybe he's hungry and he wants to get home with his groceries because that's where he was coming from. We don't know, but the story that I used to display a lack of compassion all of a sudden becomes a story of compassion because I asked, why? Why do I feel that here? Why is it whenever somebody says that I feel it down here? We tell our stories to explain our experience, and our karma gets in the way. And then the Buddha trains Bahia in the teaching here because there is no you there. And that reminded me of another little story. I'll be really short. Oh, we got all the time. My mother was widowed at the age of 79. And about the time she was 83, we helped her move into a senior community. She had her own little teeny tiny home. And my mother and I had a very good relationship at that time. Now it was on again, off again, but it was really good at this particular time. We would talk weekly. We talked about the books we were reading. We talked about the news, everything. And then all of a sudden, I can't reach her. Now, this is before voicemail, and she refused to have an answering machine. So the phone would ring and ring and ring, and I couldn't get through to her. This went on for weeks. And I asked my brother what was going on, and he was kind of out of it, as some of you know my brother. And he couldn't give me a decent answer. And it turns out she had a boyfriend. But I didn't know that at the time. And but I did, then I finally got the idea that she had this boyfriend. And I was sitting around and talking to my girlfriends about it. And I said, how could she do this to me? And this friend sitting next to me from Alabama said, she isn't doing anything to you. And I have always remembered that. Always remembered that. It is not about me. 99% of the time, life is happening and it is not about me. There really is no me there. I just can't remember that because I'm worried, I'm opinionated, I have my feelings, my thoughts, all of my effluence and my karma get in the way. Last thing I'll say is, it is a teaching about awareness and mindfulness, which is why Reb Anderson put it in his chapter on the chapter on concentration. But it's also about right speech. So I consulted Reb's book on the precepts, and I found him say in the fourth precept, all speech, and this is being upright. Zen meditation and the Bodhisattva precepts. I did not bring it because I'm not going to read from it, but I highly recommend that book. It is one of my absolute favorites, and you'll really understand that Rev is one of us too. And all speech based on self-concern is false and harmful speech. And remember, when we get to the precepts, in the fourth precept, Bodhidharma says, in the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. So again, not that we need to be harsh about this, not that we need to beat ourselves up about this. We're human. We evolved this way. But we just have to remember to release our effluence. Maybe that should have been the subtitle of my talk. Talk about the Bahia Sutra and release your effluence. That would have had them coming. One last thing I'd like to do, and then I'll stop. And that is this, if everybody would play along with me for a minute. Sit up straight, sit up like you're going to meditate. You can keep your eyes open or closed. You can face them downward like we do when we meditate. And just listen to the teaching one more time. Then, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. Thank you. And I don't have any questions, although I think I could probably come up with some. But I would love to hear if anybody has had the experience with a verse, a teaching, a precept, a sutra, kind of like the experience I had, where I had never heard it before, but when I read it, I knew it. Of course, this is here. So if you have any experiences like that, and if you feel like sharing, please share them with us. And, or you can ask questions, or you can comment, or we can sit here quietly. Yes.
Okay. Everyone, it's Coral. This is in response to your prompts just now, if there's something that like came up. I'm reading the Through Forests of Every Color by Joan Sutherland for the upcoming practice intensive group. And right at the end of that book, she starts talking about like, you know, we're talking about enlightenment, and then that word is light, right? Everything is about awakening and realization, and it's very like positive and daylight. And she brought up this thing called endarkened. And I don't know if Joan Sutherland, if she was the one who coined that phrase or if it's been around, but it's kind of like the lunar side of enlightenment, right? It's endarkenment, so it's enlightenment. And it's talking about like the darkness, the unknown, and it's kind of spooky, and like awakening doesn't happen with enlightenment on its own. It also includes this dark, ineffable, indescribable, kind of scary, unknown thing, and seeing both of those at the same time is awakening. This has been missing from my practice for 6 years. Like there was something there that I knew, and I felt it, and it was kind of scary. And once I read it in words, it just like blew open this whole part of my practice that. It was like in the periphery for a long time now. Anyway,
Thank you for sharing that. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I haven't finished the book, but you're reminding me of something. I heard early in my practice, like I'd been here a year or two, and I heard Domio talk about, well, the one thing I was thinking about when you shared was that for some people, seeing the truth is disturbing. It's not this beautiful, happy, wonderful thing that you see. Maybe it will be, but perhaps because of what Coral just shared, it can be disturbing. But Domio one time was talking about, you know, seeing the truth and everything is lit up and bright and illuminated. That's the word, illuminated. Well, I got hung up on that. And for a good year or more, as I practiced, man, I was looking for that light. I was looking for the light. Do you see it? Because I can see it right now. I can see it. It's right there. I mean, that's the way I was. And even Chosen Bays in her book, How to Train a Wild Elephant, she says it in the introduction. At some point in time, you will walk around the corner and the world is lit up. So it took me a long time to let go of that. But I finally did. But you know, this self-inquiry thing, Bahia is asking, am I an arhat? How many times have we asked, am I doing this right? Is this the way you do I see light? Is this the way you do zazen? I'm not getting anywhere. What is it doing? I mean, how many times do we question our own practice? Oh, two hands. Let's go. I don't know who came first, but I guess it's Jacob.
Hello. I'm new to the zazen
welcome
practice in terms of, you know, cultivating like a sustained practice in my life. But I have thought on similar topics for a while. I guess by way of story, you asked for a similar story. I do a lot of writing in my work, and I write for a number of my bosses. And I have a particular boss who has a very aggressive way of providing feedback. And it can get a little loud even. And dealing with this individual has been one of the hardest challenges in my professional career out of all of the jobs that I've had, because I've just never encountered such passion in someone providing feedback. And so, you know, it taught me that I identify a lot with my writing, to the point of, you know, taking a lot of that feedback personal. But even after realizing that, the next time this individual was yelling at me, basically, I couldn't help but still be triggered. You know, you still have some form of a opinion or emotional response, some effective response to what's occurring. And so I just wanted to kind of see what your thoughts were on that. You know, not only allowing yourself to be subjected to something like that, but also how do you interrelate with people other than avoiding them that aren't necessarily trying to rid themselves of their affluence?
You work hard at ridding yourself of your own affluence. And I say that tongue in cheek, but you know, your work sounded a lot the way mine used to be when I was working. And you just have to, I mean, it's your writing, I get it, but it's the writing, it's finished. You offer it, and the results are going to be the way the results are going to be. And the results are not yours. They're just there. And that is what this person across the table from you is commenting on. He's not commenting on you. That's the only thing I can think of at the moment. Emily.
Hi, Jinryu. I wanted to say thank you for your talk and for making me aware of this sutra. I was reading it last night for the first time, and I was talking to my spouse about it, and we both agreed that it's kind of like if you took all of the Buddha sutras and fed them into an AI and said, write me a sutra, this is what it would come out with. Because, I mean, you've got everything. You've got the asking three times and the wandering around and, just everything. But I also wanted to say, in reference to what Coral brought up, I was recently reading, I don't remember the author, but it was a commentary on the Sendokai and how darkness is actually used as enlightenment in there, like kind of turns it on its head, because in darkness, there's no discrimination. You can't see forms differently from each other. I don't know, that like that whole thing of light being bad and dark being good, but there's no good and there's no bad, is something I was like really surprised to read. So I just wanted to bring that up, but that's the Sendokai.
Thank you. And I'm remembering how it goes. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. And then what else? In
My life is
darkness. Oh, that was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me of that. Ruth Ann, were you about to say something?
Oh, yes. Your stellar talk has brought forth some remarkable comments right now. And so I can muddy that exchange at the end here. I recall this must be a Christian comment. I was in the right aisle, wrong pew, because this brought clarity to me just now. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Everybody.
Anna.
Jill, thank you so much for that talk. It really, the timing was really good for me. I feel like I've been really caught up lately in something out there. And I've been aware of like try and bring it in here with a lot of failure, like not sort of like a revolving door. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna come inward, and then I just like wake up and I'm out there again. And it's really a lot of opinions about others. But when you asked the last question at the end, I immediately thought of the book. It's called Training in Compassion by Norman Vivner, which is probably like the second Zen book that I read. And the thing that like struck me like lightning when I read that book, and I still think, I mean, I read it years ago and I think about it all the time still, is one of the slogans is don't try and figure other people out. And his commentary is, you can't even figure yourself out. Like, why would you think you could figure other people out? Just let that go. Like, work on, just keep working on figuring yourself out. There's no end to that. And that has struck me so much. And I see such a connection between what you shared today and getting caught up out there is just the same as trying to figure people out, kind of with the overlay of a heavy dose of opinion. So I thank you. I feel like that connection really helps me.
Good, thank you. Is that a book on the paramitas as well? He did one on the
It's
paramitas.
Lojong.
Okay, it was Lojong. Okay, I remember that. I have read that a while back too. I should read it again, I guess. Oh, Susan.
Hi there. Thank you so much. Many, many years ago, before I stumbled into the local temple, I heard someone say, the people I was hanging out with said repeatedly, what so-and-so thinks of you is none of your business. And that's one of those modern koans, I think. And for how long did I, maybe up till today, did I not really connect that with what we're doing in our practice? But so that was always very confusing. What I can see from this conversation and your talk and everybody else's comments is that it's not about that the other person is none of my business. It's that what I think about it and what I say about it and what I cook up about it ought not to be my business. If I can make it, if I can see it as that dust I'm stirring up, then it just blows away with breeze. Thanks so much, Jinru.
Thanks, Susan.
Yes.
Oh, I've got a,
yeah.
This is Katie. And I've got a short one like that. It goes, stop reacting to what I didn't say. And it's something that my husband and I have been doing therapy, and he's kind of discovering that he might be on the spectrum. And like people on the spectrum often don't, you know, the face will kind of go when they're thinking and they're not as good at, you know, presentation. And it, you know, it sort of, I just felt like that when everyone was giving their little expressions, that popped up in my head. So I didn't share it. Don't react to what I didn't say.
Don't react to what I didn't say. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Because it's like someone already said, was it you, Courtney? Someone said, don't try and figure yourself out. I mean, don't try and figure out the other person because you can't even figure yourself out.
Norman.
Yeah, he's good. Yeah, he's good. Anyone? It's a lovely day in Portland. I hope it's lovely, lovely fall day where you are. Shall we call it a day? Thank you all for listening. Like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha, all Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha vajna paramita.
Thank you, Jinryo. And everyone.
Thank you, Ruth Ann, and everybody.
Thank you, Jinryu. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You know, when it stops here, all this stuff you're doing out here, nobody can see it. I wanted to see what people said in the chat.
That's right, Jinryu. You can get used to wearing sweatpants from when you're in the cloud.
Yes. And dare I say it? Pajamas?
Pajamas. Yeah, for me, it's kind of whatever it is. Whatever's comfy.